Welcome to the program that explores the complete harmony between the record of nature and the words of the Bible. This is the November 7th, 2006 live web broadcast from our studio in Glendora, California. This is Joe Aguirre, joined by two scholars today, David Rogstad, Ph.D. from Caltech in physics. Welcome, Dave.
Hi, good to be here.
And biochemist Dr. Fuzzle Rana, Fuzz for short. Hello there, Fuzz.
Joe, Dave, how's it going?
Ph.D. from Ohio University in chemistry. A lot of ground to cover today, and let's describe that for you. In the first hour, Dave has a report here. Where did all the helium go? Is the question that we're going to answer with the help of our trusty scientist over here. Yes, that's your cue. Oh, please go ahead.
I was going to say the helium, you know, wound up going
into balloons.
And we're going
to happen to have one right
scientific experiment right now as we speak. So bear with us. We're trying to determine where all that helium went.
A balloon left over from the 20th year celebration.
Yes.
So what Fuzz wants to do is to find out, in fact, whether there is helium in this balloon, and he's going to do that by breathing it in. Now, what if it isn't helium, Fuzz? What if it's some other toxic gas that you're taking into your lungs?
I think I found the helium, Dave. Here's some of the missing helium.
Try it again. You got to push all the air out of your lungs.
I think he's breathing out instead of in. Okay, try it again, Fuzz.
Did that work that time? Here's a missing helium.
Please do not adjust your computer.
Of course,
that is Dr. Fuzz Runner.
We're talking about helium-3, not helium-4. So I don't know how much helium-3 is actually in helium-4, Dave. Trace amounts,
it's
I would
probably
imagine.
Trace amounts. Yeah, I think so.
All right. Well, with that experiment, thank you very much, Fuzz, for playing the part so well. Dave, you are going to explain a discovery that helps solve a discrepancy in Big Bang cosmology, thereby providing evidence for RTB's cosmic creation model.
Correct.
So we will explore that,
we'll talk about that
in just a minute. Another discovery, do embryonic stem cells produce tumors? Fuzz Rana reports on a dopamine study in mice that gives reason to be skeptical of any promises this controversial technology might offer. And, of course, stem cells have been in the news very, very much in recent weeks. In fact, Fuzz, you've been interviewed a number of times all over the country on embryonic and adult stem cells.
Sometimes with helium, other times without
That's
helium.
That's right. So we will discuss that in the second segment. In the third segment of this hour, Kenneth Samples will join us and help answer the question, does God really care about politics? We'll explore the election from a theological perspective. So that's coming up a little bit later.
We're not going to tell you who to vote for.
Hopefully you've already done that or we'll do
that
soon.
Figured that out.
In the second hour, the current issue of Time, dated November 13th, which I'm sure many of our listeners have already seen, is titled God versus Science, a spirited debate between atheist biologist Richard Dawkins and Christian geneticist Francis Collins. Of course, we interviewed Dr. Francis Collins just a few weeks ago on Creation Update. So we will discuss the ramifications of that article at the top of the hour as well. A lot to cover, plus your calls at 866-RTB-RADIO. You can also email us, as several have already. Hopefully we'll get to some of those. CreationUpdate@reasons.org. That's one word, CreationUpdate@reasons.org. Okay, having set it up that way, let's go ahead, Dave, and talk about this first discovery that scientists have learned more about the helium and where it went, other than Fuzz's lungs just a few minutes ago.
In fact, let me just make a comment for those listeners who are wondering what in the world is going on at this normally serious program that we have here.
When you let Fuzz Rana dictate how it should go, that's what happens.
Well, when we were discussing what we were going to do in the program beforehand, of course, we had a lot of fun around the table discussing some of the discoveries that we were going to come up with. And then there's a lot of questions that we ask one another and a lot of jokes that get told in the process. And Fuzz made the comment, wow, if we recorded this, people would maybe listen to our program. It'd be more interesting. And then, of course, he'd like to put in a little more sports there, sports talk or something like that. But that's the reason that this program opened with such an odd little commentary and experimentation.
Not to mention my sucking helium.
But you didn't swallow. That was the thing. Oh, no. What is it? No. You didn't inhale.
I didn't inhale.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Anyway, what I'd like to talk about, it's kind of an interesting question. You know, there are a lot of critics of Big Bang cosmology in the scientific community. And these critics are often making the statement that in order to be an acceptor of Big Bang cosmology, you got to have faith because there are a lot of things that it doesn't explain, or there's a lot of discrepancies in the observations that we have made in the universe and what we would maybe expect if Big Bang cosmology is really true. I think the things that they really have difficulty with, though, of course, are these major components of Big Bang cosmology, and that's things like dark matter and also the
cosmic background radiation.
Well, no, not the cosmic background the radiation, but the I'm just out of my mind now. The
dark energy.
Dark energy term that is required, and that. The largest component of the universe is this dark energy, and we don't really know what it is. And so people have real questions about that, so that in spite of the fact that Big Bang cosmology does seem to explain a lot of things very well, there are these exotic characteristics of it that that give people really heartburn. And so, of course, they're pointing out any discrepancies that they can to undermine the credibility of this as a good explanation. But I think as we've commented a number of times, I certainly have on this program, what's of real interest, if this theory has any merit, is what happens in time as we make more discoveries. Is the theory supported more and more? Are the discoveries that are made in agreement with the theory, or is observation and the theory separating, getting farther and farther apart as time goes on? And it seems as though there's more and more agreement between science, the discoveries, the observations that are made, and the theory, and that's what this paper is about today. A few weeks ago, I reported on a question of where is all the lithium gone?
Yes, I remember that.
And Bang predicts that there will certainly be a certain amount of lithium. It's only a small fraction of the original primordial material that is manufactured in that Big Bang process. Just to remind listeners who maybe aren't up on this stuff really well, the Big Bang, of course, is the idea that the whole universe began with a very small region of space. Well, region, it wasn't space. It was space compacted into a very small, almost infinitely dense place where the temperature was extremely hot. And then it expanded out from there, kind of like the uncoiling of a spring, giving off energy. And that energy, at a certain point, the temperature dropped to a sufficient degree to where that energy could be converted into matter. So over a short period of time, the early phases of the Big Bang, the energy was converted to certain forms of matter, hydrogen being the largest component, something on the order of 90% of it's hydrogen, maybe 10% of it is helium, and then there are a number of other materials, small amounts of lithium and other elements, but a very few number of elements are made at that time. And then it's later, as the whole universe evolves and stars and galaxies are formed, it's in those stars that the rest of the matter is made and spewed out into the interstellar medium and is available for making up planets and eventually people. But in the beginning, the Big Bang and the models that we have for it predict a certain amount of hydrogen and helium and lithium and so on. And as I reported a few weeks ago, there up until that time, there was this discrepancy pointed out that the amount of lithium that we actually observe in stars where we think they're stars that are, early, old stars left over from a very early phase of the universe. The amount of lithium in those stars was not anywhere near. It was a factor of two or three lower than what you would expect based on the Big Bang model. And what that discovery at that time was revealing was that by having better models for what actually goes on within a star as it burns and the motions, the swirling around that goes on within a star as it burns, they were able to show that, in fact, the helium that would have been there left over from the Big Bang actually got eaten up, burned up in the stellar process. Well, in sort of analogy to this, there is a similar kind of problem that has been in the minds of scientists for a number of years, and that is, where is the helium? Now, it's a little bit different in that the helium that is predicted does, in fact, exist. It exists in about the amount that would be expected by the Big Bang, but in fact, we would expect to see, because we understand the stellar burning processes, especially in stars that are sort of what are considered to be low-mass stars that are about maybe similar to the mass of our sun, maybe up to a factor of two higher than our sun. We understand the burning processes in those stars and that we would expect that burning process to actually produce helium. And it's not just helium. Helium, of course, comes in several isotopes, and it's helium-4 that is the largest component. Helium-3, which is a different isotope of helium, is actually the one that we're talking about here. And the Big Bang predicts about, I think it's 1,000th of 1%, 0.001% of the original mass was in the form of this helium-3. And that, in fact, we would expect to see, based on this process going on within stars, to see about 10 times that amount, or about 0.01, a hundredth of a percent of helium-3 in percentage of mass, total mass. In fact, we don't see that at all. We see more like what came out of the Big Bang. And so while this is a little indirect, there were certainly those who disparaged the Big Bang on the basis of this and argued that what we see is not anything that came out of the Big Bang. It's just what was produced in stars. And what is produced in stars wasn't as much as what we think it should be. And in any case, it undermines the credibility of the Big Bang. But what this paper is just showing up in the October 26th issue of Science. Actually, it's the version of the Science magazine called Science Express. It's kind of a faster online version of the magazine. And there's a team of astrophysicists, including one of the lead authors was Peter Eggleton from Livermore, Lawrence Livermore National Labs. Another one was John Latanzio from Monash School of Mathematical Science in Australia. And then there were a number of other authors, too. And they did some very careful 3D, three-dimensional simulations of these burning stars in order to see much more in detail what was going on within these stars and how did they burn. And these are stars that are have evolved to the point to where they are, instead of looking like our sun, they have actually burned up pretty much all of their hydrogen, and they've turned into what are called red giants. And there's actually a transition point. They call it the helium flash point, where this transition takes place. And there's a lot of instabilities that go on, this transition between burning hydrogen and then now burning helium. And there's a lot of funny things that go on, instabilities and so on. And so they wanted to model that as carefully as they could. And in the process, just sort of by accident, they discovered that they could account for the fact that there wasn't as much helium in these stars as you would have expected on the basis of previous models for this type of star. And so what happens is this: the models are correct in that this helium-3 is in fact produced produced at a rate something like 10 times that of the Big Bang, but the instabilities and the various other processes that go on within the star actually cause this stuff to get mixed into the star and burned up. And so as a result, we don't have the amount of helium coming off of these stars in the form of solar winds like we would have expected them to produce. So it's you know, some people kind of say, well, you know, big deal, what's the, you know, but it is a big deal. It's a big deal because it takes one less sort of nail that people are trying to put into the coffin of the Big Bang and removes it and shows that, in fact, you know, this model has merit in explaining a lot of what we see going on. It's important to us, of course, as Christian apologists here at Reasons to Believe, because a key part of our creation model is that the universe began at some point in the past. It was created. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Mm-hmm. And we think that that is very well tied in for a number of reasons with the Big Bang that scientists are talking about.
So again, this removes a discrepancy in Big Bang cosmology, and because Reasons to Believe incorporates Big Bang cosmology
into our model,
cosmic creation model,
right.
It buttresses our model.
That's correct.
Which is derived from the Old Testament. In the beginning, God created.
Yeah. Well, there's actually three or four key concepts that are present in Scripture that describe the creation, and in particular, the beginning of the creation. One of them is clearly the one you just made reference to. In the beginning, God created. Mm-hmm. So there was a beginning of this universe. Another is this word that's used over and over again in some of the prophets, which is that the word that's used is not expanding, stretching. The stretching out of the universe. Mm-hmm. It's a concept that certainly includes the idea of expanding, and it's used over and over in Scripture to describe this cosmos, this heavens that we have to look at as we look up. And so it's a term that clearly refers to the discovery that we live in an expanding universe, and that's part of this Big Bang. And then there's a couple of others too. The fact that the universe is eventually going to end is something that we're realizing is true from a scientific perspective. And of course, the Scripture said this a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is the fact that the universe in its expansion is slowly cooling off. And while the Scripture doesn't use that term directly, it uses the term that of fixed laws of physics or fixed laws of the universe that we live in. And it's on that basis that we see a cooling off. Mm-hmm. And we see this observationally. So all of these are part of a Big Bang model and are part of our creation model.
Okay, great. Thank you for that, Dave. Another confirmation of Big Bang cosmology. All right, so now we know where that helium went. It wasn't just in Fuzz's mouth there a few minutes ago.
Could you say, I know that we're trying to get to a break, but could you say that, in a sense, the contents of Big Bang cosmology found in Scripture are analogous to the notion of the Trinity? That while the term is never explicitly used, the concept of the Trinity, God's Trinitarian nature, is clearly espoused throughout the Old and New Testament. And likewise, while the term Big Bang is never used, the concepts or the elements are clearly there in Scripture.
Outlined in Scripture in different terminology. And we, looking at this, make certain inferences about what the overall picture is. And then we invent a term to describe it. And I think that's not a bad picture to have in your mind when you think about it.
Okay, great. All right, thank you for that. And Fuzz, regarding this general subject, you've been interviewed a number of times on the specific subject of stem cell research as it relates to this whole debate in the political world right now. Nobody needs to be reminded of that fact. It's election day, and this is one of the big issues that a number of states all around the country. In fact, you were quoted in the current issue of People magazine
and according to my kids, it's a real good issue to be in because the front cover has Reese Witherspoon, and she's been with her boyfriend for 7 years, and they're breaking up. So my kids are excited that I made
it. Is it her boyfriend? It's not her husband?
Who knows?
Yeah. That's how much I think it's her husband.
Oh, okay. Yeah. See, gosh, Dave, you're really up on this stuff.
Yeah, right.
I'm surprised.
People like Astrophysical Journal.
I need to come to you to find out the celebrity gossip,
yeah,
I guess.
Right.
Oh, boy. Nevertheless, Fuzz, you have been interviewed all around the country because there are measures on the ballot in many states. And, of course, this is a hot button
right.
issue.
And even places where they're not measures, this has become a highly politicized issue where typically the Democratic candidates are viewed as being pro-science and pro-stem cell research, and the Republican candidates are typically being viewed as anti-science, standing in the way of this type of research that could potentially benefit, at least this is the claim, could potentially benefit millions of Americans who are currently suffering from tragic and horrible diseases and debilitating injuries.
Yeah, yeah. And Fuzz, you have spoken on that subject many times on this program. You've written articles, Today's New Reasons to Believe. You've been interviewed. So you are the go-to guy. And here you have another in a long line of discoveries that again calls into question the promises often bandied about on embryonic stem cell research. So here's another one on, did I get that right, dopamine study in mice? So explain that one for us, please.
Sure, and just to take a step back, oftentimes what I'm finding is that this issue is portrayed as kind of, as I mentioned earlier, or at least alluded to earlier, as a science versus religion issue or science versus a right-wing ideology. And really, that's not the case whatsoever. The message that we're trying to convey is that if we bring this into the arena of science exclusively, the science really helps us determine what direction to go when it comes to these types of technologies that we're talking about. If we can set aside the politics and look at the science, again, it will dictate the direction that we should go. And I'm also finding, too, that many people just simply are not aware or not conversant with the science surrounding stem cells, and so they get very confused and are not quite sure who to believe or what to believe or what's going on. And so part of what we're trying to do is just educate people so that they can make informed decisions when it comes to these very important issues. And one fascination that there is, or why there's so much fascination with embryonic stem cells, has to do with the way in which these stem cells have been traditionally viewed by the scientific community, by biomedical researchers. These embryonic stem cells are cells that come from human embryos. In order to get them from human embryos, you have to destroy the human embryo, which is why they're so controversial. People are ethically upset by destroying a human embryo, at least some people are. And these cells that come from the very early stages of embryonic development, before any type of specialization happens in the human embryo, these cells are called totipotent cells, meaning that they have the total potential to develop into all the different cell types in the human body. And so this gives them a very interesting property in the mind of biomedical researchers who want to come up with therapies in which they can develop cells that they can implant into the tissues that are damaged because of disease or injury. Some of the tissues in our body has the capacity to regenerate. And these tissues typically have what are called adult stem cells associated with them. And these adult stem cells are a special type of cell that can, under the right circumstances, undergo cell division and generate replacement cells. So that the cells that make up the tissue die, then there's a source of replacement cells so the tissue can regenerate itself.
What would be an example of that in our body?
Well, like our skin.
Okay.
Our skin
sure,
is an example.
An obvious example.
You know, when you cut yourself, that you're able to heal. The reason why you're able to heal is because the tissue can repair itself. Mm-hmm. And so there are stem cells that are part of the skin. Blood. Blood is another regenerative tissue. You don't think of blood as a tissue because it's a liquid, but it's a liquid tissue that can regenerate itself. But there's other tissues like cardiac tissue, nerve tissue, muscle tissue that's non-regenerative, and largely it's because there are no stem cells affiliated with it. So if somebody suffers a spinal cord injury, the body can't repair itself. And so that tissue, that nerve tissue, is permanently lost. And because of that, that nerve function then is lost. So the idea is, could we come up with a way to develop cells that could replace those dead neurons in a spinal cord injury? And embryonic stem cells are touted as being those such cells that could be coaxed into developing into neurons that could be implanted, or maybe even implanted as a stem cell itself into tissue and cause it to have these regenerative properties.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Now, you know, so often when it comes to this discourse, we hear about these wonderful potential benefits of embryonic stem cells. And even though a human embryo has to be destroyed, look at the benefits that are out there. Look at all the people that could be helped. Surely we should be exploring this and to save people from all this suffering. But again, we hear about these potential benefits and the promises. But tragically, when it comes to the public discourse, we very seldom, if ever, hear about the real problems with embryonic stem cells. And this particular paper that I want to talk about, which was published just a few days ago, in fact, in a journal called Nature Medicine, actually highlights and illustrates very nicely what are some of the potential problems with embryonic stem cells. And this particular study was focusing on Parkinson's disease and use of stem cells for treatment in Parkinson's. And interestingly enough, this paper was published just a few days before the very first airing of the very controversial commercials that Michael J. Fox starred in Missouri and in other places in the country where he was campaigning for pro-stem cell candidates. And in this particular study, they're looking at Parkinson's disease. And part of the etiology of the disease in Parkinson's is that the neurons that produce dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter, die. And as a result, because there's no neurotransmitter of this particular type available in the brain, or it's at very low levels, people with Parkinson's disease struggle with motor function. Well, the idea then would be, could we generate dopamine-producing neurons that we could then implant into the brain of Parkinson's patients and make up for that lost function and maybe not cure them, but at least provide a very effective treatment and a therapy for them? And so this particular paper was exploring that idea, and what they did is they generated a dopamine-producing neurons from human embryonic stem cells in a laboratory, and then they took those and they implanted them into the brains of mice that had Parkinson's-like symptoms. They genetically engineered what they call Parkinsonian mice, which are mice that suffer from the same disorder. They can't produce dopamine. And
now, they took the embryonic stem cells from mice?
No, from humans. So these are human embryonic stem cells.
Oh, really?
That they then
put into the mice. Oh.
And they were looking to see short-term, was there any type of benefit? Mm-hmm. And in fact, they actually discovered that there was improved motor function in these mice. Now, what is significant about this study is that similar studies to this have been done before. But in these earlier studies, it's very difficult to get human embryonic stem cells to transform into the cells that you would like them to transform into. And so there's all kinds of cookbook recipes that are used to try to get them to do this. And typically what happens is you produce a cell culture that has dopamine-producing neurons in it, but it's not a pure cell culture, meaning some embryonic stem cells have not undergone transformation. Others have transformed into other types of neurons. And when you take that gamish and you implant it into the brains, again, of, let's say, mice, they tend to form tumors because, again, you have cells that are kind of unwieldy. They're not in their natural environment. They're not fully regulated, so they tend to form tumors. These scientists were trying to overcome that really devastating problem by coming up with a procedure to grow dopamine-producing neurons that were high purity. And what they discovered, again, was that when they implanted them into the brains, good news, improved motor function. However, what they noticed is that in the brain, some of these neurons began to become de-differentiated. They began to revert back to a more primitive cell state. And they also noticed that there were some growth of other types of epithelial nerve cells, which tend to form tumors. And so they didn't see tumor formation, but they saw essentially the very beginning stages of tumor formation. And so this caused deep concern because formation of tumors is not a good thing. This is totally reverses any benefit that you might get from having dopamine-producing neurons. So this was really a devastating result in that it highlights the fact that embryonic stem cells tend to be tumorigenic, but that even the best attempts that they could make to try to avoid that really were unsuccessful. And this is, again, just one of the types of problems that you see with human embryonic stem cells. This is widely recognized in the scientific literature. It's freely written about, freely discussed. For some reason, it doesn't make its way into the public discourse. And so people are making decisions based on partial information. And how much support would there be for human embryonic stem cell research, given the fact that, again, you're destroying human embryos, when people realize that this isn't an open and shut case? Yeah, there's some potential there, but that potential seems to be outweighed by very significant problems, again, tumorigenicity being one of them. There's other problems that we could go into as well. It's not a guaranteed technology, really. That's the point. And it's unfortunate that this is not discussed more openly in the public marketplace of ideas.
When you have given some of these interviews, have you had opportunity to explain some of these various things that you're talking about?
Yeah, a lot of the interviews essentially comprise the very things that we're talking about.
You probably can't go into as much technical detail.
No, this is far more technical detail. I usually give the top line result. But, to me, the whole idea of embryonic stem cell research is unnecessary because there are advances now with adult stem cells. Used to be thought not that long ago that adult stem cells couldn't really develop into the wide range of cell types you would need for cell replacement therapy. But we now know that this isn't the case whatsoever, that in a laboratory you can get adult stem cells to transform into very interesting cell types, one of which are dopamine-producing neurons. This has been done in several studies. And so adult stem cells don't seem to be tumorigenic like embryonic stem cells do. And there's other benefits that...
Well, they're not going to suffer the rejection mechanisms that...
Exactly.
...would normally occur with foreign cells.
Because you would be your own donor.
You'd be your own donor.
The rejection, which is very much an issue with embryonic stem cells, isn't there. Mm-hmm. So that's another problem
So, Fuzz, this is another study that comes in response to the charge that is often levied against people with Christian convictions, that all you guys can come up with is a Bible verse or your Christian worldview saying that we shouldn't destroy these little tiny, tiny cells. So you're saying, no, it's the science also that concerns me, that troubles me. I am concerned about Michael J. Fox and other people like him. If you go down a certain path, that may not be the path you should go.
Well, the real tragedy here is that this is costing people, this is costing human suffering and maybe human lives. And Michael J. Fox, and I hold no animosity towards him, I think he's desperate, as I would be in that situation. And I don't mean that to be critical of him or to ridicule him. I think that's a wrong tactic to take. The guy is desperate, and he's hearing that this is a possible technology and is frustrated because he's suffering. He knows that other people are suffering. He's trying to be an advocate to end human suffering, but he's not fully informed scientifically. And the fact of the matter is he's his own worst enemy, because by focusing attention on this, I think, doomed to be failed technology, you're diverting interest away from other technologies that actually may provide benefit. We're diverting resources and attention away from the areas that really are showing true, genuine promise, which don't have the same types of problems associated with them as embryonic stem cells. And so the tragedy here is that we're delaying the treatment of diseases like Parkinson's because of this stubborn commitment to embryonic stem cells. We're not letting the science and the technology development dictate the path we should go on, but there's political and economic agendas that get mixed in with this that I think at the end of the day become have tragic consequences. Yeah. And so from my standpoint, this is a very important issue that that we need to be outspoken about as Christians in terms of impacting our culture. This is one way that we can do that, is by giving people the right information about this.
Based on your reading, Fuzz, in the scientific journals, is it fair to say at this point in time that there has been no real benefit that has come from embryonic is as opposed to adult stem cell research?
Well, any benefit that is accrued is
offset by the problems. Okay. Like in this particular study, yeah, it did improve motor function, but that's going to be short-lived because you're going to have tumor formation, mm-hmm. which probably is going to create a whole host of other problems. The therapy perhaps is worse than the disease itself.
So far... Yep. All that promise has not really produced any clear results that are long-term results.
Yeah, and again, this is very much discussed openly in the scientific mm-hmm. literature. I know you're trying to go to a break there, Joe, but let me just read the final sentence in the abstract. It says, these data also mandate caution in the clinical application of human embryonic stem cells, given the potential for phenotypic instability and undifferentiated expansion, which mm-hmm. basically means they're going to form tumors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, Fuzz, thank you very much for that. An important study. And we are joined now by Kenneth Samples. Welcome, Ken.
Hi, Joe.
You are an author of Without a Doubt, Answering the 20 Toughest Faith Questions. And, Ken, although you are a theologian and philosopher by training, it doesn't hurt to delve into subjects that we like to talk about around the lunch table, and that is politics. Who can't help but talk about that today? And especially from the perspective as a theologian, which you are, Ken, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions because I think there might be some people who are looking at this election and the way it might turn out, and they might be disappointed and they might have a number of questions on their mind. And I guess the big question would be, does God really care about politics? So that's the big question. Then maybe we can kind of unpackage it a little bit, because I think there are a number of Christian doctrines that come into play. God's sovereignty, our responsibility as citizens, what is the right way to vote based on a Christian worldview? Do I have the right worldview? Because there are evangelicals on the right and on the left. Perhaps many people on the right are not aware that there's an evangelical left who also bring out Bible verses supporting their positions. But I think for a lot of Christians, they might be thinking, you know, gee, since 1994, we've been incrementally working at getting things done. We've gotten the right people elected, and we've got all this momentum going, and now suddenly it looks like things are not going our way. So I wonder if you might address that particular perspective theologically, what might come into play there.
Yeah, let me begin by saying that I think it's clear that certainly God cares about elections. God cares about the way countries are governed. Here I'm going to start with a Bible passage. Hopefully it's the right Bible passage. It's from Romans 13, which is a very critical section of Scripture talking about civil magistrates, talking about what our obligation is to governing authorities. Paul writes in Romans 13, "Everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God." So, you know, when you have a government, the presumption is on the part of the Apostle Paul that God is ultimately in control, and these are his agents. Now, when Paul wrote this passage, certainly the people who were the governing authorities in the ancient world were not terribly good people. But Paul nevertheless says that government is established by God, and we need to submit to it. And the only other times when we should not is when the government coerces us or commands us to do something that Scripture says we shouldn't do. But he goes on in verse 5, "Therefore, it's necessary to submit to the authorities not only because of possible punishment, but also because of conscience. This is why you pay taxes, for the authorities are God's servants who give their full time to governing. Give everyone what you owe him. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honor, then honor." Paul here very clearly states that the people who commit themselves to full-time governing are God's agents, and in the best sense are meant to make the best possible situation for the citizens. Now, that doesn't always play out, but to cite one more passage from Paul, Ephesians 1:11, it says, "In him we are chosen, having been predestined according to the plan of him who works out everything in conformity with the purpose of his will." So I think these passages clearly indicate that Christians have a civic responsibility. If we're asked to pay taxes, we are indeed to do so. We are to give honor and respect to people who are in governmental authority. Even though sometimes we don't agree with their worldview or their political ideas, we have a civic responsibility. And I would say, and here I'm leaning on Augustine's idea of the two cities idea, we have a civic responsibility in the city of man, and it is built upon our greater responsibility of being citizens in the city of God. So does God care about politics? Yes. He is going to work out all things in conformity with his will. Do we have a choice in the matter? Are we free agents? Yes. How does God's sovereign will and our will work together? Well, there you'd have to come to one of our lunch meetings and hear the debates that we present. But certainly we have a responsibility to be good citizens, and that's perfectly in keeping with his sovereignty.
Mm-hmm. Ken, another question that might arise from someone from an agnostic or atheistic perspective is that as they look at the evangelical landscape, and in their mind they're thinking right-wing Christian evangelical, they're all lumped together, they might be thinking, there's ultimate evidence that your God does not exist. Because here you have been claiming, you know, all along that if we get the right people elected, we've got George Bush in office, all these things will happen, and we'll get this Christian agenda put through. But the atheist will trump, and again, we're making the assumption, and it may be an incorrect one after this day is over, that the election doesn't quite turn out the way some Christians hope it does. But having said that, the atheist might say, see, it's all a matter of chance. I mean, Democrats rule the House for a while in the Senate, then Republicans come back in. They're just politicians. There's no God. We just vote, and that's just the way it happens. So they might say this is evidence against the Christian position, because you've put so much stock in that view and you've prayed to your God. He's not answering your prayers.
Well, Joe, I think that there's a couple things we could probably say in that context. Remember, when Paul's writing these statements about submitting to governing authorities, Nero's sitting on the throne.
Remind us of what he did.
And Nero, of course, is one of these terrible emperors who was persecuted Christians, was very vicious in his method of ruling. He was a total hedonist. So Paul says we have a responsibility to honor and respect government, even when it isn't what we would necessarily like. We, as Americans, on the other hand, have an opportunity to affect what kind of political structure is involved, and that's a good thing. I think, though, when we look at these types of issues, I think the Bible says that God is ultimately in control of history. Now, that doesn't rule out our choices. It doesn't rule out our opportunities to make selections in a democratic form of government. Nevertheless, I don't think we should necessarily think that we know exactly how God is going to work all these things out. To be perfectly candid, Joe, Christians have never universally held any particular view as binding when it comes to the issue of the government. I mean, some Christians think we ought to create a theocratic state. We ought to change society to abide by biblical laws. Others think that there should be a distinction between the city of man and the city of God. You know, there has never been a universal position in which Christians have said, this is our view about government. There has always been debate, discussion, dialogue about how best to deal with these types of issues. And I think that's going to certainly remain. But clearly, we have respect and honor for government. Mm. And I think that flows out of our scriptural texts. And therefore, we have a civic duty.
Mm-hmm. You know, kind of in a sense, to respond to that question, too, is there's the assumption there that only Christians can only belong to a particular party, the Republican Party or Conservative Party. But really, when you look at, I think what should be, in my view, an overriding concern for Christians as they engage in politics is essentially upholding the dignity and the sanctity of human life and having a high regard for human life. In a sense, that's what our country is built upon in some respects. But really, those ideals are essentially bifurcated between two parties. The Democrats that tend to be more focused on social justice, and the Republicans that tend to be more pro-life in terms of being anti-abortion and opposed to things like embryonic stem cell research. So really, as a Christian, you could be, in a sense, very much committed to the Democratic Party because you feel like social justice is perhaps more important than a pro-life agenda and vice versa for a Republican.
Yeah. But let's finish up because, Dave, I think you had a question. Ken, I don't know if you're in the midst of making a final comment, but maybe we can kind of reintroduce how to assess elections from a theological perspective. But maybe it's time for your follow-up question.
Yeah, well, in the course of Ken's comments, he was quoting that verse from Romans 13 that really is strongly emphasizing our need to honor and respect those who are in authority over us. We in our country have the privilege, of course, of participating in that process, as Ken also made mention of. I was just curious to know what Ken's response is to those who live in countries where you don't have that freedom, and whether there's ever a place for undermining the authority, rebelling or resisting or even trying to do in an authority. I'm thinking of, say, someone like Bonhoeffer in Nazi Germany, where he was part of a conspiracy to do away with Hitler.
Well, I think the scriptural answer is absolutely yes. If the government commands us to do things that the Bible forbids, then we have to go with the Bible. Mm-hmm. Or if the government forbids things that God commands, we have to go with our authority, God. I think, though, Dave, in light of that, in light of Romans 13, Christians have an obligation to be very careful, to be very deliberate, to be very reflective before they break the law. The law is established by God. There are circumstances when I think the government either forbids or commands things that we cannot follow.
Makes laws that are really contrary to God.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think in terms of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, I would have agreed with him. I have to tell you, though, that if I were back at the time of the Revolution, I could see
The
American Revolution. I could see someone making a counterargument that as oppressive as King George was, mm-hmm. that England was largely a Christian country, so should the colonials do this, I think that would probably be a hotly debated topic from mm-hmm. one point or another. Ultimately, I think the Americans did the right thing, but it wasn't an easy thing, and Christians should never break the law without great time of reflection and prayer and deliberation about it.
Mm-hmm. You know, it seems to me that maybe a guiding principle in making that decision is the government merely oppressive versus is the government perpetrating clear evil?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so for example, if you go to Nazi Germany and you look at Hitler and what his regime was doing in terms of exterminating Jews, as soon as that information, I think, becomes available or is understood, I think at that point the attempt to overthrow the government is reflecting not Romans 13, but really do we sit back and idly watch that type of evil being perpetrated against another people? This goes beyond mere oppression mm-hmm. and difficult circumstances. It really is, again, perpetrating an evil where I think at that point there seems to me to be an obligation, and maybe God is using you as a tool. Instead of ballots, there's bullets, so to speak, using you as a tool to affect the regime change that he would desire, if you will.
And it's a difficult one because, Fuzz, there are people who have suggested, and not without good reason, that, in fact, Hitler remaining in power led to a more swift devastation of the Nazi government because he was so terrible as a commander-in-chief. Mm-hmm. If he had been killed, more competent people may have been brought in. So there are a lot of factors mm-hmm. as a Christian considers all of these things. But I agree with you. When you see the government committing clear evil, the obligation of the Christian, I think categorically, is to oppose it.
Yeah. Sort of a scriptural example that is maybe could be at least argued as reverse of that is when you look at David and the way that he responded to Saul, and he would not touch the Lord's anointed. And Saul was doing a terrible job of leading the country contrary to the commands of God, and yet David wouldn't do anything about it directly. So that's another factor, a component of this whole issue that she surely needs to be taken into account.
Yeah, it's, whenever a Christian decides to break the law, that is a monumental decision. Mm-hmm. And I think we have an obligation to consider what the possible implications will be. Mm-hmm. It may seem really smart to blow up an abortion clinic until you discover that innocent people are killed in that action, and it galvanizes the other side against the pro-life position. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You want to think carefully about these acts.
Well, I'm glad you brought up that last example. That was going to be my question, in that some people might say, there's my green light. We have state-sponsored abortion. So Kenneth Samples says if the government is oppressive and is involved in this type of activity, then I need to go out and get myself armed. So you're saying, no, it's not that easy. Thank you for clarifying that. Okay, we don't mean to belabor that issue, but it is an important one, and there are theological implications because we have a Christian worldview, and that affects politics as well. Thank you for your comments on that, Ken. I'll ask you to hang in there because we want to talk about another subject. But first, let's go out to Mike, who's been waiting patiently in Little Rock. Welcome, Mike.
Hello.
Yes, you're on with Dave Rogstad, Kenneth Samples, and Fuzz Runna.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I was listening to Greg Kokel's podcast, Stand to Reason, and this past and he was talking, or somebody called in asking about general relativity and Einstein. And I can't remember the exact nature of the question, but basically Greg was saying, he admitted that he's not a physicist, and so he was kind of speaking above what he knew what he was talking about. But he was talking about a view that Einstein might have been wrong about how time works, that time actually doesn't slow down, as you approach the speed of light, but rather the physical properties of like, say, a clock would slow down to make it appear as though time is slowing down. And then he went on to talk about a tape series by William Lane Craig called God, Time, and Eternity. And I was wondering if anyone there had heard of this view and would like to talk a little bit about that.
Mike, here, this is Fuzz, a biochemist, answering the question on general relativity. But hey, I know no bounds to what I'm about to espouse. But no, the reason why I'm jumping in, and I'll let Dave jump in as well, is I've heard Hugh discuss this issue before, both privately and publicly. And William Lane Craig actually takes the view that there are problems with general relativity because he finds it incoherent. And I'm not quite sure. I've never read William Lane Craig's writings on this. Again, so I'm kind of echoing Hugh's statements. But it seems like as if William Lane Craig has some difficulties philosophically or coherently with general relativity, and therefore is not convinced that understanding of time is correct. However, I will say, being here at Reasons to Believe for 7 years, there has been time after time after time on this program and elsewhere where Hugh and Jeff Zwierink and Dave have talked about discoveries that continue to support the idea of general relativity. This is an idea that's extremely well established and extremely entrenched within the scientific community, not for no other reason other than it's been experimentally verified. And so whether William Lane Craig or other philosophers perceive it as being incoherent or have difficulty with it on philosophical grounds is largely immaterial because the theory has been well established. So I think William Lane Craig, with all due respect, he's a brilliant Christian apologist and philosopher. I think he's, if that's how he's reacting to it, I think he's got, he's on in difficult grounds. And the one thing I think that we learn from modern physics is that nature is really strange. and it can be extremely bizarre and doesn't make sense based on our experience. But keep in mind that we're moving much more slowly than the speed of light, that we are macroscopic beings that have no direct contact with the microscopic realm. And so quantum mechanics and general relativity seem bizarre to us and counterintuitive to our common experience, but it's because our experience is so limited. These ideas are well established, as bizarre as they are, they're well established ideas experimentally, and I don't think we can just simply dismiss them because we view them or think of them as being incoherent. If we do think of them as being incoherent, the problem probably lies in the way that we're thinking, more so in the theory itself.
I maybe just make one comment, and that is I think it's important to make a distinction between the theory as it's described mathematically and those mathematical equations are solutions for those are made in the context of certain boundary conditions that we think are present in this universe, and then of course what those equations then predict. We have to make a distinguish between that, which is the thing that's really being tested here and proven to be accurate in its description of the universe, and how we visualize those things in our own mind and interpret them and come up with ways to try and verbally describe them and think about them. I think this is particularly true in the microscopic world, where you have to deal with quantum mechanics, and there's a lot of things there that you just can't visualize in your mind. And in relativity, of course, being able to visualize the things that are being described there, especially when it talks about dimensions higher than three dimensions, is basically impossible for us to get our mind around them. We can't conceive of them, and so we kind of use analogies and other ways of trying to visualize them and to explain them to ourselves, to give descriptions. But you know, what may work for one person won't necessarily work for another person. And so you have to recognize the limitations of that and restrict yourselves when it comes to the real testing and the question of how true is a particular theory. You have to limit yourself to the actual mathematics and the description that goes on within the equations.
You know, when I was a graduate student taking quantum mechanics as part of my training in chemistry, you know, I struggled with that issue. I can't mm-hmm. visualize this. This doesn't make sense. And I finally reached the point where I said, I'm just going to accept it. I'm not going to try to visualize it mm-hmm. or picture it. I'm just going to accept it. And then suddenly everything kind of fell into place. Mm-hmm. It made it easier. Not that quantum mechanics is ever easy, but it made it easier right. for me to enter into that realm and to use quantum mechanics to understand chemical phenomena.
Actually, it's a bit harder for me because I tend to think about things intuitively. And as you say, our intuition is tuned to the universe as we experience it, not the way quantum mechanics or relativity works. So I had a hard time, but others are able to do better.
In high school, I liked geometry because I could just think about it and see how it works.
Intuitively.
But with this stuff, it's not. And I've read, as a layman, I've read the Green's book,
Elegant Universe.
The other one that he wrote after that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I can understand his examples that he gives in the book, but then try to explain it to somebody else and I get lost mm-hmm. when I actually try to explain it. So maybe I didn't understand it.
Well, join the club.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of the things about, I'm going to interrupt just one more moment here, Ken.
I was
at Caltech back when Richard Feynman was there, and Feynman was a great person who could help you intuitively understand a lot of this very difficult physics. So we'd sit there and listen to a lecture and think that we understood everything, and we'd follow the problems and the clever solutions that he would come up for solving a problem, and then we'd go away and try and do the homework. And then we realized, hey, we're not Richard Feynman. We can't do these problems because we don't understand like he does.
I would say I maybe take a little different position than Fuzz has articulated. I would say this. I would say that if a scientific theory is genuinely incoherent, it can't be true. But the question that remains, of course, is whether what Dr. Craig says about general relativity squares with what it is conveyed by Einstein. So I'm not troubled that Bill would question or raise philosophical questions, as I think he's a first-rate philosopher. But the question is, it seems like there is solid scientific support or mathematical support for it. So then the question is, how do we resolve that type of tension? But I think we raise questions all the time. I raise questions in my book that certain theories are incoherent, and I argue that they can't be true. But again, I was in a room when Dr. Craig and Dr. Ross were debating the issue, and it was going back and forth about these types of issues. So, you know, if general relativity is incoherent, I would say it can't be true. I think my colleagues here would say that it is not, that it is well established, and maybe that it is out of our ability to totally comprehend.
And I wouldn't say I disagree with you, Ken, because in a sense there's two – well, here again, a biochemist talking philosophy. Just beware, everybody. But, you know, when it comes to trying to discern what is true, there's the correspondence test and then there's the coherence test.
Yeah.
And in a sense, Dave and I as scientists really look at correspondence mm-hmm. as being very, very important and recognize that maybe things appear to be incoherent, but if things are corresponding to nature very well, then that raises questions, not so much that incoherence is not a valid way to assess truth, but maybe we don't have a full enough picture to truly assess whether or not something is coherent or incoherent. But I would agree with you, if something is truly incoherent, I don't think it's going to be capable ultimately of being true in the mm-hmm. correspondence sense as well.
Right.
They work together, but if I saw something that was marvelously coherent but didn't correspond very well to truth, then again, I would raise questions whether or not that theory is true, even though it coheres nicely.
No, I agree. I would say coherence is a negative test. If something is incoherent, it can't be true. If it's coherent, it might be true, but it may have to pass other tests, like correspondence.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. Mike, thank you for your call. Please call again with another question next time. All right, we have been all over the place today. Let's go back to the phone lines in studio. By the way, Dave Rogstad, Kenneth Samples, and Fuzz Rana. This is Joe Aguirre. Let's go out to Portland, Maine. Roger. Welcome, Roger. You're on with the gentleman here.
Hi, thank you. I have a political comment on Fuzz's statement in the last hour, and I also have two questions regarding Dr. Collins, although depending on time limitations, I may only ask one question about that. But anyway, my political comment is that, Fuzz said that Republicans tend to be pro-life and Democrats tend to be in favor of social justice, and therefore there are some evangelicals leaning towards the Democratic Party. I think there's a deeper issue here, and that is the issue of core worldview. In other words, liberal politicians tend to have a worldview that embraces relativism, and conservative politicians tend to have a worldview that embraces more of moral absolutes. And I think that there are many more liberal politicians among the Democratic Party and correspondingly many more conservative politicians among the Republican Party. All of the extreme liberal politicians are Democrat, and there are no extreme liberal politicians that are Republican. I think there's a huge difference there. And this affects many other issues besides the pro-life issue. This affects the granting special rights for homosexuals. The liberal politicians are typically in favor of that. And the liberal politicians are typically in favor of limiting religious freedom, especially the religious freedom of Christians. And conversely, their conservative politicians are in favor of granting greater or at least constitutional religious freedom for Christians. So I think there are many more issues, and then there's the big core worldview issue. And that's my comment.
I wonder, I'm going to butt in here in front of Dr. Rana. I think your point is a very good one. In fact, I'm going to give you an analogy of it. I suspect, though I wasn't living when this happened, I suspect that when Adlai Stevenson and Dwight Eisenhower were debating, both running for president, Eisenhower, the Republican, Stevenson, the Democrat. I think that while they had vigorous disagreements about policy issues, about defense issues, about the Soviet Union, et cetera, I think they largely had a singular worldview. Whereas today, and I was raised in a Democratic home, you know, my dad's proudest moment was saying I voted a full Democratic ticket. Again, he was an FDR, Harry Truman Democrat, John F. Kennedy Democrat. I would say today that the Democrats and the Republicans sometimes have very different worldviews. And, right. And that to me is very profound.
Fuzz, did you want to comment anymore?
No, I wouldn't necessarily dispute anything that Roger said. I think that's very perceptive that there really are fundamental worldviews. Mm-hmm. But you do have many people who I would consider to be very faithful Christians who do find allegiance with the Democratic Party. And what they perceive there is that party represents, in essence, social justice. Or
that's
at least
the ground
a platform.
On which
feeding the poor.
Yeah, mm-hmm. A platform where there seems to be social justice. And in their minds, that is something that they view as being more important than necessarily a pro-life stance. Not that they would necessarily be in favor of abortion and things like that. So it's just simply to say that that you can be a Christian, I think, and find allegiances with both parties, that both parties have platforms that do have features, I think, that do resonate with the Christian faith, and then aspects of their platforms that I think would be troubling to the Christian faith, and where somebody falls down on you know, in terms of aligning themselves with different political parties, oftentimes has to do with more what they really feel resonates with them in terms of their Christian convictions, more so than one party necessarily represents a Christian perspective better than another party. So that would be my comment or my response, Roger. But again, I'm not necessarily saying that your analysis is not valid. In fact, I think you have you raise very good points that I think are I would agree largely with.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Roger, and your question.
I still think the core worldview issue trumps all the other considerations, but I'll go on to my question about Dr. Collins. A few weeks ago, he made some very controversial statements, in my opinion. But
referring to the interview we had with Dr. Francis Collins that we had on a primetime edition that was October 17th. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. And I have two questions about what he said, but I can postpone the second question if depending on time considerations. Anyway, the first question would be for Fuzz primarily. And that is, Dr. Collins basically stated that he could conceive of these irreducibly complex machines within the single cell coming into existence through stepwise evolution. And everything I've heard, I mean, Dr. Behe has stated that that is utterly impossible and that there's no chance that these machines could have come into being through stepwise evolution. So my question basically for Fuzz is, is there any chance, realistically, that these machines within the single cell could have come into being through a stepwise evolutionary fashion?
You know, that's a great question, Roger. And I'm largely persuaded, to get my position out on the table, I'm largely persuaded by Michael Behe's argument for biochemical intelligent design using irreducible complexity as the means to argue for it. And I think Behe raises some very interesting questions that may very well be intractable problems for evolution to account for the formation of irreducibly complex structures. Having said that, however, there are evolutionary biologists who have done thought experiments that largely represent very much broad brush hand waving, but they still have done thought experiments where they have shown conceivably through processes called such as exaptation or through gene duplication type processes and things like that. They've done thought experiments in term that where they can show that at least in principle, it's not totally inconceivable that irreducibly complex systems could actually emerge through some kind of evolutionary process. Now,
where these parts are performing other functions, aren't they?
Exactly.
And then these parts somehow magically stumble together and now perform some new function.
Right. Well, for example, like the bacteria flagellum, which is the kind of the poster child, if you will, of intelligent design. Mm-hmm. There's something called a type 3 secretory system in bacteria that is essentially a partial flagellum, mm-hmm. that secretes proteins into the extracellular environment as part of the pathogenic nature of some bacteria. So they would point to something like that and say, look, this is not a full flagellum. This is a partial flagellum that has another function, and we could envision how these things could essentially co-opt a motility function over time. Now, this is not necessarily an open and shut argument, because you could argue, well, the type 3 secretory system is itself irreducibly complex and that you really haven't solved the problem. But what is going on is that evolutionary biologists are constructing conceivable pathways, though not detailed, at least conceivable pathways by which these structures could emerge. And Francis Collins, if I have one criticism of him, I think that he too quickly buys into the standard evolutionary argument without being reflective enough. Now, I think Behe has responded, and others have responded on his behalf, to these types of challenges quite adequately. But the fact of the matter is, you can point to at least hypothetical scenarios where these types of systems could emerge. My criticism, and this is a mild criticism of Behe's argument, is that the way that it's framed sets yourself up, I think, to being having the argument dismissed. Because his argument is essentially a negative argument, where the focus seems to be more on what evolution can or can't do, as opposed to pointing out positive features in the cell that point to the work of a designer. And I think irreducible complexity is a feature that you would see in systems that are produced by designers, by human designers. And if you see that type of system in a cell, in fact, many systems like that in the cell, it's at least rational to begin to ask the question, could this indeed be the product of an intelligent agent? And these are then things that you could point to as positive evidence for design, apart from getting into a spitting contest as to what evolution can or can't do. And so, I think in a sense, Behe hasn't framed the argument in the best possible way. And at the end of the day, you can never really prove a negative. And so you never really can establish something as being designed with irreducible complexity as being the argument.
But you can assign a probability to it.
Probably. It's not as easy to do as you would think. It's difficult because there's a lot of things we don't know fundamentally about biochemical systems. So you could attempt to assign a probability, but again, that probability is subjected to legitimate criticism. So, I think the thing is that Francis Collins isn't totally out of bounds, but, I think that nobody has really shown with any type of rigor that you can produce an irreducibly complex system through evolutionary processes, but they have at least generated hypothetical scenarios where it's not totally outlandish to make that claim. And that's what Francis Collins is latching onto, where, again, I think he is too quick to accept, without it being critical, evolutionary explanations for life's origin and life's history.
All right, so okay. Would you say that those evolutionary theoretical scenarios are very improbable, in your opinion? What would you say?
I would say that they're not overly compelling, and that there's plenty of places to raise questions as to whether or not these explanations that are being offered are rigorous enough to truly account for the origin of irreducibly complex systems. And in fact, if you look at Behe's response many times to the rejoinders to his argument, typically what he's pointing out is that the arguments are very much top-level, superficial, hand-waving type scenarios that haven't established a system as being irreducibly complex, that have rigorously been demonstrated to have evolved in a stepwise fashion. And I would agree with his rejoinder But the fact of the matter is an evolutionist could at least say, I can conceive of how this could originate. Therefore, I'm not compelled to buy the argument. It's not that I can necessarily fully dismiss it, but I don't think that this is the irreducible complexity, when framed in negative terms, establishes conclusively intelligent design. Likewise, I would say if you frame it in positive terms, it doesn't conclusively establish intelligent design either. But at least you could argue that this is a positive marker or an indicator that an intelligent agent is at work.
One among many that you could come up with.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
And the more markers, the greater the probability that intelligent design was indeed involved.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
There's plenty of markers, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That would be how I would respond to it. So.
Right. Okay. How many irreducibly complex systems are within the typical cell?
I think you could make an argument that that virtually every biochemical system is irreducibly complex. I think you could make that argument, and that something that we write about in the book Origins of Life, Hugh and I, that life even in its most minimal form is irreducibly complex as well. That it's kind of like irreducible complexity squared. That there's a minimum complexity below which life can't be pushed. In terms of certain biochemical systems and operations being present. And so life itself, chemically speaking, displays irreducible complexity. And then when you examine individual biochemical systems, in my mind, it's hard to – I think you could argue that virtually every biochemical system is at its core essence irreducibly complex.
So the evidence is strong but not totally conclusive, at least as yet.
Exactly.
All right, Roger, we're going to have to leave it at that for this time.
All right.
Thank you for your call. Good,
thank you.
Good questions, as usual, from Roger. We want to touch on a subject here that just came up in conjunction with Roger's question on Dr. Francis Collins. By the way, we have that archived interview. That's in the Creation Update October 17th edition. So please be sure and listen to that interview with Dr. Francis Collins. He, by the way, was featured along with Richard Dawkins in the latest issue of Time, a cover article on the November 13th issue of Time magazine, which we just got here yesterday, God versus Science. Interesting how that's put there. A spirited debate between atheist biologist Richard Dawkins and Christian geneticist Francis Collins. Given the importance of Time magazine and in the culture and the fact that it's on the cover article, and we've had interaction with Francis Collins, we thought we'd get a little bit of discussion on that just briefly, and then we'll get to the call. But Ken, you in particular wanted to make some comments on that article.
Yeah, I read the article yesterday, and often when I have discussions with Fuzz and Dave, I don't understand a lot of the details that Fuzz talks about when he delves into biochemistry, and similar with Dave. When Dave talks about, some of the details of physics, I have a hard time tracking because my background is not in science. But I do look very carefully at the way they argue and how measured they are, how deliberate they are, how careful they are in the way they present their position. And that was what struck me about this piece. When I read this debate, give and take, and they cover a lot of ground in this article, and you don't know how much is cut out and how much is left in. But I was very impressed with Francis Collins. I felt that in this discussion with Dawkins, he came across as being every bit as competent as a scientist as Richard Dawkins. He corrected Dawkins when Dawkins engaged in an ad hominem criticism, bad-mouthing creationists. Francis Collins said, look, it doesn't help the dialogue to badmouth people. I thought that was, touche. But as well, I felt that Collins was very deliberate. He came across as a man of faith, as well as a man of science. And I thought that on the other hand, and obviously I've read some of Dawkins' material, I'm not terribly impressed with the way Dawkins argues. But in the article, Dawkins struck me as a bit uncharitable. He struck me as not knowing a great deal about the details of religion. and very dismissive. Whereas Collins, and again, I'm not completely comfortable with some of the things Collins says. I don't accept theistic evolution. I am much more critical of that idea of how it could be biblical. But I was very impressed. I thought that if I were to pick the winner of that dialogue or debate, I think Francis Collins came across as much more persuasive, much more deliberate and measured in the way he presented his ideas.
Mm-hmm. Now, Fuzz, you've read both of their recent books, The God Delusion by Dawkins and The Language of God by Collins. Do you have a comment?
Well, I thought I thought that both books at times were extremely superficial. I thought that Collins's presentation in terms of arguments for God's existence was a relatively, again, superficial treatment. I really felt that he gave a very powerful description of his conversion to the Christian faith. His testimony was very powerful. The fact that he was calling, I think, atheists onto the carpet and challenging them with regard to their worldview was very good. But I felt like the arguments he was making for God's existence using the moral argument were relatively superficial, that there was it was a much more nuanced, detailed discussion that he could have presented. Now, part of it is he's trying to make the book accessible, I think, to a popular audience. On the other hand, I thought Dawkins' book was very superficial as well, in terms of the argument for atheism, in terms of the issues he raises about the harm or the damage that come from religion. You know, his arguments for an evolutionary explanation for morality and for religion, I thought, were largely hand-waving, just-so stories. So I didn't really feel like either book presented the best possible case for a rigorous evidential basis for the Christian faith or a rigorous evidential basis for atheism. I thought that if one really wanted to have robust arguments from both sides, at the end of the day, these books really don't accomplish either of that. I thought that in terms of being balanced and measured and thoughtful, however, probably Francis Collins' book was far more so than was Dawkins' book. I thought, as you said, in terms of your response to Francis Collins' presentation in the article, I would agree that there was a much more thoughtful presentation in Francis Collins' book than there was in Dawkins' book, though I thought, again, Collins was a bit superficial. But again, I attributed that to really this being a book for lay audiences more so than there wasn't that depth of thinking wasn't there. I think it was there. It just, I don't think he chose to go into those depths, to plumb those depths.
Yeah. One comment from a layperson here, and then we'll go to Levi. What struck me about that article is that there's nothing I read in there that I haven't heard you guys say or write about before that has been answered here sufficiently, to my mind, especially Dawkins' insistence on the multiverse hypothesis. Ken, I'm sure you read that over and over. I mean, our guys have been writing about that and talking about it regularly for years. But that seems to be one of the things he was clinging to.
And I thought, and this is a Francis Collins won a point with me. He critiqued multiverse in light of Occam's razor, which is something I agree with, as I think does Jeff Swearing.
Yeah. Okay, great. Let's go out. Levi has been waiting patiently. Levi from Georgetown, welcome. You're on with Dave Rogstad, Kenneth Samples, and Fuzz Rana.
Hello. Yeah, I was wanting to know kind of when you believe the flood occurred, and is there a reason behind why, or what evidences did you all use to choose a local flood versus a worldwide flood?
Okay, well, Levi, the short answer to your question is in the book The Genesis Question, written by Hugh Ross, there are probably three or four chapters that go into extensive detail, kind of laying out why we espouse essentially a local flood theory as opposed to a global flood theory. It's largely scriptural, although there are some scientific problems with a global flood idea. The argument is largely scriptural that's put forth there. There also is an article, I believe, on our website written by – he's a geographer. What's his – the article appeared in Facts – for faith.
Sargianis or something?
Steve Sargianis.
Yeah.
That you can access that article for no cost, where he puts forth a defense of a local flood, that would indeed be possible within the Mesopotamian plain. But the argument is largely a scriptural argument, where we would maintain that a couple of points. Number one is that humanity had not yet spread beyond Mesopotamia, and so that God did not need to bring about the total destruction of the planet to deal with humanity's sin and the defiling nature of humanity's sin, but rather that he could take care of it by confining the flood to Mesopotamia. The other point is that when you look at the way in which the language is written, it's clear that there's a perspective, that from Noah's perspective, it appeared as if the entire earth, and keep in mind that the word earth can mean land in the original Hebrew. It doesn't necessarily mean the entire planet, but it can mean the land, that the entire land was covered with water as opposed to the entire earth, but that from Noah's perspective, everywhere he looked, given the magnitude of the flood, even a local flood, it would have appeared as if the entire earth was covered with water. And there's other passages, for example, outside of Genesis 6 through 9 that speak about God when he would never again return the earth to its original state, which would be described in Genesis 1-2. Psalm 104, Proverbs 8 are two places where those statements are put forth when it describes the creation of the land, that again the earth would never go back to a water world statement. So in order for Scripture to agree with Scripture, you can't take a global flood interpretation. But those are just some very quick top-line explanations for why we think the flood was a local flood as opposed to a global flood. Again, a very detailed, a compelling discussion is found in the book, The Genesis Question. In terms of the time frame for the flood, we would place it probably in the neighborhood of, I would say, between 20 and 40,000 years ago. Hugh tends to place the timing of the flood more recent than I would place it. I would tend to place it closer to 40,000 years ago. Hugh would tend to place it closer to 20,000 years ago. But that would be that would be the window of time that we would take.
You know, may I ask, is there, because there's a lot of, I'm a geologist at college right now, and I have seen a lot of sedimentary structures that don't seem that they've taught us about, but they do not seem to be answered by a normal geological setting over a long period of time. And it does, to me, indicate that there was a worldwide flood, just because there's some structures out there that don't seem to be created by, let's say, or they seem to be created by water and laid down in water. And I don't know, is there any discussion going on between a worldwide flood view and a local flood view? Is there any way to reconcile those two views, or is it pretty much an exclusive argument?
Well, you know, I'm not a geologist. In terms, though, of geological features, you know, it seems to me that you could have, processes that would produce structures that would happen over a slow processes that would happen over long periods of time, that could happen in a multitude of environments, aquatic environments, terrestrial environments, and then you could also have processes that would be catastrophic processes that would imprint upon these slow processes, again, happening in a variety of environments. So to me, you know, I don't know that that would necessarily preclude either a global flood or a local flood, necessarily speaking.
Both. I think we would argue that there's both catastrophic flood-type things. I doubt that we would or feel that there's evidence, excuse me, geologically for a global flood, but certainly large floods, as well as these slow processes going on and used to explain geological features. So we would probably differ then on that with those who are the young earth creationists, who would take a global flood view and argue that all the geological features that we see today are a product of this global flood.
All righty, thank you.
Okay, well, thank you for your call. Levi, please call again. Gentlemen, we've got just a minute left, so any closing comments on anything? Anything we needed to patch up? Any loose ends anywhere?
In terms of politics and Christianity, I would just say vote early and often today.
There you go.
That's sounds kind of democratic to me. But
yes. Okay. Well, one, since you mentioned it, Fuzz, one thing to keep in mind, Roger was calling from the Northeast. I think somebody who lives in the South, I'm thinking of the Southern Democrat, Zell Miller, is that the name?
Yep.
Might not fit that view that Roger is talking about, where there are worldview differences. But anyway, that was quite a good comment there. Okay, well, thanks for listening to Creation Update. Be sure to join us next week where, again, our scholars will bring new discoveries to the table. These discoveries provide evidence for the God of the Bible and for the Christian faith. We will archive this program and provide show notes as well. So all the papers that were discussed, any books and other materials, we will put those in the show notes. Remember to jot down the phone number for next time so you can get in the queue, 866-RTB-RADIO. That's 866-782-7234.
This has been a presentation of the Ministry of Reasons to Believe. If you would like to know more about other resources offered by Reasons to Believe or have questions about issues related to science and the Christian faith, please visit our website at reasons.org or call us toll-free at 800-482-7836.